running and sordid story. It starts in March 2022. At that time, my electronic intifada colleague, Asa Winstanley, who rather fittingly is rather busy at the moment because of an excellent book he wrote on the weaponization of anti-Semitism, he revealed that this notorious Zionist lobbying group, We Believe in Israel, was attempting to secure the removal of Loki from the streaming platform Spotify due to his strident support for Palestinian liberation. At the core of its complaint are six tracks of particular concern, four of which were recorded by Loki, all of which expressed solidarity with Palestine and its oppressed people. At the time, there was when Asa's exposure of this led to the creation of a petition opposing the move, which garnered tens of thousands of signatures, quite rightly. And to this day, Loki stubbornly remains on Spotify.
David, Latifa also mentioned, didn't she, in her package at the beginning of the show, she mentioned BICOM's We Believe in Israel project. I mean, how does that relationship work?
So We Believe in Israel was set up in 2011. They had a conference and then had several other conferences in the years following that up to around 2015 or so. And it's led by this guy called Luke Akers, who you can see on the screen there, rather red chap, who is, of course, one of the most right-wing people in the Labour Party. He has been, was what, for a while, until Corbyn came to the leadership on the National Executive Committee of the Labour Party. And he's led We Believe in Israel since 2011. It's a kind of subsidiary of BICOM. Akers famously, rather famously, is also an ex-arms industry lobbyist, as we saw in the film there. And it's a subsidiary which is supposed to bring together a whole network of pro-Israel groups. So, for example, when it was first created, the Reut Institute, which famously wrote that study back in the day, talking about the need to bring together the Israel lobby against hubs of delegitimization, which is the Palestine Solidarity Movement. And it reported at the time that this was the emergence of the pro-Israel network, and it had already been very successful. So we see in this moment the creation of We Believe in Israel, the beginning of the Zionists working together in an unprecedented way, which of course is only intensified through the next part of the decade when Jeremy Corbyn becomes leader of the Labour Party, and they very much coordinate to try and bring down Corbyn, and so that they're effectively all the Zionist groups are working together with direction quite often from Tel Aviv.
Mm-hmm. Of course, Akers lost his seat on the National Executive Committee when Jeremy Corbyn was elected as leader, but of course he's been returned to the National Executive Committee since Corbyn was suspended by Sir Keir Starmer. But Kit, it seems, doesn't it, that Luke Akers and his chums have been continuing to lobby Lucy Fraser, the Minister for Culture, to cancel pro-Palestinian artists from online platforms. I mean, are they likely to be successful, do you think?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I mentioned this campaign which started against Loki in March last year. This has intensified significantly, and it seems this is specifically due to the assistance of Lucy Fraser. It has been disclosed that, yes, that the Board of Deputies and We Believe in Israel have reported the problem of Loki's wonderful, groundbreaking music being on Spotify to her and her digital culture, media and sport department. Now, Fraser is, of course, a former intern for the Israeli Justice Ministry. This is a direct line into the heart of the British government from the Zionist lobby. Now, to make matters even more perverse, okay, so there's an individual called Rachel Blaine, who was We Believe in Israel's press officer at the time that they started their crusade against Loki. What was her next role? Oh, she's the public affairs director of the Conservative Friends of Israel, which is this hugely influential Zionist lobby group within the ruling Conservative Party. Former Foreign Minister Alan Duncan, who, despite having absolutely repulsive views on pretty much every conceivable issue, did have a principle support for the Palestinian people, and was incendiary in his condemnation of Israeli genocide and apartheid. He commented in his diaries that the Conservative Friends of Israel think that they run the Foreign Office, and they do. So this is the level of influence that We Believe in Israel and that the Board of Deputies has within the government. I mean, I might add that Rachel Blaine, who was, yes, a long-standing campaign director, she falsely declared Loki's three-part long-lived Palestine rap anti-Semitic tropes.
Yeah.
It's absolutely appalling.
No, absolutely. But David, I mean, are there any other Israel lobby groups that are pushing for control of the music industry?
Yes, I mentioned this organisation before on the show. There's an organisation called the Creative Community for Peace in the US, which has a whole range of music industry executives as part of it. And it sort of masquerades as being this music industry body who wants to have nice things like peace in the Middle East. But, of course, it's a front group for Stand With Us, which is an organisation, an Israel lobby group set up by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and indeed funded directly by the Israeli government. And it's had all sorts of fundraising events where money has come from the music industry. And it's an attempt to make sure that there are no pro-Palestinian words or artists signed by big labels. And, of course, that means that there's a really very significant influence of the Zionist lobby on the music industry, both in terms of what music is recorded and indeed even on which artists are signed to the major labels.
Mm. They all have sort of cuddly, sort of benign-sounding names, don't they?
They do.
Yeah. Kit, it seems, doesn't it, that the Zionist lobby were successful in removing the work of two Palestinian singers. I mean, what happened there?
Sure. So, you know, I mentioned that there were six tracks of particular concern to We Believe in Israel. I mean, on top of the four by Loki, there were two, one by Ambassador MC and another by Shadi Alberini and Kassem Al-Najjar, who they're both Palestinians. And so, yes, in April this year, much to Spotify's disgrace, the tracks by these artists were removed. So, you know, there was Al-Najjar's, rather catchy Strike a Blow at Tel Aviv was removed. The death of Israel, that was removed too. And I mean, this is how we know that Frasier was involved, because the development was cheered triumphantly by the two organizations involved, and also the sickening Zionist Journal of Rep of the Al-Jamaica. They were boasting about the access that these groups had to Lucy Frasier. So they obviously see that as a good thing. In a democratic society, this would be considered reprehensible. But of course, Britain is not a democracy.
No, indeed. No, it sort of masquerades as one, but certainly leaves a lot to be desired as far as democracy is concerned. But look, we'll come back to the discussion in a moment after this report into the way in which prominent Zionists have penetrated Spotify and now hold high-ranking positions in the organisation.
Spotify's infiltration by pro-Israel forces is multi-pronged. Since the failed campaign against Loki, there have been several key changes at the company. The recently appointed senior counsel in legal and business affairs at Spotify is Andrew Joseph. He was previously a sergeant in the Nahal Infantry Brigade of the Israeli military. Spotify also established a safety advisory council to regulate content on the streaming platform. This council includes an organization that is chaired by a former director of Bicom, which is lobbying Spotify to remove pro-Palestinian content through its We Believe in Israel project. The Institute for Strategic Dialogue, which sits on the council, was founded by Israel lobbyist George Weidenfeld, who was a political advisor and chief of cabinet for Chaim Weizmann, the first president of the Zionist entity. Today, the Institute for Strategic Dialogue is headed by former Bicom director Michael Lewis. In the US, the head of ISD was Gil Shiva, who was chairman of the American Friends of Israeli settlement Keshet Elon. The Spotify Council also features Megan Phelps-Roger, formerly of the Westboro Baptist Church. She claims she was cured of anti-Semitism by Israeli David Abibol, who is sponsored by the Israeli Ministry of Tourism. Ronaldo Lemos is also on the Spotify Council, and at the same time, he's on the Facebook Oversight Board, which includes Emmy Palmer, founder of the Israeli Cyber Unit and formerly of Unit 8200. The Spotify Safety Council also includes Swedish academic Christer Mattsson, who works with Yad Vashem, which is funded and controlled by the Israeli regime. Spotify has now directly partnered with an Israeli company called Riverside for a new video streaming mechanism. The company is stuffed with Israeli military and intelligence veterans. Conflicts of interest galore.
David, tell us a bit about this Institute for Strategic Dialogue then.
So the ISD, as it's known, is one of the lesser known but really very significant Israel lobby groups. It's an organisation which is not widely known. It is quoted in the media, but it's not widely known in Britain. But it's active in the UK, in the US, and indeed across the whole of Europe. And it's a Zionist penetration operation to make sure that policies at the national level and indeed at the local level all around the world, including in Australia, are consonant with Israeli government prognostication. So in particular, it works on the question of extremism. So it wants to try and influence government policies and indeed local government policies so that even if a government at a national level takes a view against Israel, that the local governments and city governments will be undermining that. So it's an attempt to foster Zionist views wherever it goes. And one of the particularly successful things it's done is to penetrate European Union counterterrorism policy. So there's a counterterrorism policy organisation called the Radicalisation Awareness Network, and the ISD, along with another Zionist pressure group, have totally captured that in alliance with British intelligence, a matter we've talked about before in the show. So ISD is a really very important organisation. It's a Zionist penetration operation.
Right. Well, Kit, I mean, what do we know about the funding of the Institute for Strategic Dialogue? I mean, where does it come from?
Yeah, I mean, this is listed on their website, and I would urge your viewers to go and check it out for themselves, because it is an absolutely remarkable rogues gallery, like a who's who of like some of the worst organisations in the world. So you have Zionist lobby groups such as the Anti-Defamation League. You have intelligence cutouts like the National Democratic Institute, which is a wing of the National Endowment for Democracy, the founders of which admit does publicly what the CIA once did covertly. And then you have a welter of foreign ministries, the British Foreign Office, the US State Department, a wide variety of NATO member state government. Now, its purpose for the most part, when it receives this money, is to declare a particular thing its funder doesn't like to be disinformation. So, for instance, like throughout the pandemic, ISD was funded by the British government to frame any and all criticism of COVID-19 protection measures, or indeed even mask mandates or digital passports, as dangerous extremists. In late 2021, when the UK was, of course, mulling another national lockdown, it published this absolutely extraordinary report, which suggested that people who opposed lockdowns represented a severe terror risk. Of course, at the start of the next year, the British government decided the pandemic was over, and then this was promptly forgotten. It hasn't even had a chance to age badly because it's been memory. So, yes, I mean, just by looking over its funders, we can get a very clear idea of the kind of interests it serves and the kind of viewpoints it's attempting to align on completely false grounds.
Yes, indeed, indeed. But, David, I mean, how relevant is it then, do you think, that you've got a former BICOM director who's heading up the Institute for Strategic Dialogue?
Well, this is a guy called Michael Lewis, a South African entrepreneur. He's involved in biotech and in the fashion industry. He was a director of BICOM. He's funded BICOM over the years. He has a foundation, one of the biggest Zionist family foundations in the UK, the Stanley and Zia Lewis Foundation, which funds a whole range of Zionist output outlets, you know, the normal ones, the Jewish Leadership Council, the United Jewish Israel Appeal, but also, of course, funding Toramet, which is involved in settlements and involving, and also funding the UK Friends of the Association for the Wellbeing of Israel's Soldiers, which, of course, funds the IDF. Mm-hmm. So that you can see the kind of politics that are involved here. And he now is the chair of the ISD, and indicating the strong Zionist links that there are with this organisation, and the way in which the network of Zionist think tanks and lobbyists all work together, have cross-cutting membership, and are actually engaged in a kind of coordinated activity across a whole range of topics, including, in this case, extremism.
Yes, indeed. Well, Kit, I mean, what do we know about the rest of the Spotify Safety Council?
Sure. So, I mean, it's interesting that the Spotify Safety Council actually funds ISD, which strikes me as a conflict of interest. But the ISD is far from the only Zionist actor in a position to pressure Spotify to cancel Loki. So there's also an individual on its Safety Advisory Council called Kristen Mattson, who is a Holocaust educator who's tied to the Israeli government-controlled Yad Vashem. He has appeared at numerous events sponsored by the IHRA. And then in 2019, he was the lead author on a rather opaquely funded academic study of perspectives on the Holocaust among Palestinian refugees in Sweden. No prizes for guessing where the financing came from. There's Ronaldo Lemos, who is also a member of Facebook's oversight board, which is likewise part of the council. Now, one of the board's key founders was Emmy Palmore, who is a veteran of Israel's notorious Signals Intelligence Agency Unit 8200. Who, as the Zionist State Justice Minister, oversaw the creation of the Israeli cyber unit, targets pro-Palestinian speech online, and has bullied and harassed and threatened and lawfared scores of websites into taking down tens of thousands of pieces of content. A really cheery bunch.
Yes, indeed. Well, David, I mean, what do you make then of these other members of this Safety Council?
So this is like we've seen with a number of other different social media outlets, isn't it? I mean, we've talked before about Twitter. And yes. Before Elon Musk took over Twitter, there were a whole range of Zionist organisations who had effectively sewn up what was called the Twitter Safety Council, exactly the same name
Indeed.
As the Spotify one there. And, of course, what they do is they stuff these councils with Zionists. There are never any people who would advance the interests of Muslims as a class or Palestinians or who are opposed to Islamophobia or racism in a sense more generally. And instead they have them stuffed with Zionists. And that's an indication of the structural way in which they lean. They lean towards focusing on anti-Semitism and focusing in particular on fake allegations of anti-Semitism. In the case of Loki's songs, of course, not a single syllable in anything he's ever done is anti-Semitic. But nevertheless, they come up with this nonsense about conspiracy theory, which again is a red rag to a bull in terms of actually any having any purchase in the world. So this is about a Zionist control over the way in which these corporations operate, and the corporations allow that to happen by appointing all these people.
No, indeed. Well, Kit, I mean, what about this Israeli company Riverside that Spotify has partnered with?
Sure. So, this was set up by some hardcore Zionist folks, Hillary Clinton, a very prominent user, interestingly. And yes, it starts right with Israeli occupation force veterans. So, for example, one of the senior engineers is a four-year veteran of what's notorious J6 and Cyber Defense Directorate. And meanwhile, their data analyst team has individuals who spent many years in the force. So, to say the least, the Spotify ops are stacked heavily against Loki. I know him personally. I can tell you to an absolute certainty, he isn't intimidating the Israel lobby, and neither are the fans. Just like the Palestinian people, world over, remain defiant in the face of the unending Zionist attempt to raise.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much indeed, Kit. I'm afraid we've actually run out of time again today. So I want to thank our guest, Kit Klarenberg, for joining us again today, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. So until next week, when we'll be back with more investigations and analysis, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Allahu ya Allah subhanahu. الحمد لله الله ولا إله إلا الله الله يا الله والله أكبر.
Dear brothers and sisters, you are listening to The Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio. In this special episode, we select a short part of Imam Khomeini's will. Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his pure progeny, said, I leave two great and precious things among you, the Book of Allah and my household. It should be noted that the tradition of Thaghalain has been reported from the Prophet successively and by many sides among all Muslims and in the books of the Sunnah, including the six reliable collections, using various phraseology and on different occasions. This noble tradition is an unequivocal evidence for humanity as a whole, particularly Muslims of all schools of thought. All Muslims for whom this evidence applies are accountable, and if there be an excuse for the ignorant people, there will be none for the scholars.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to another episode of Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio. I am your host, Sayyid Ayman Rizvi. In the last episode, we were talking about one of the speeches of Imam Khomeini, which was delivered to the scholars of Qom. One important point I like to present and I like to extract from his speech that Westerners and some non-Muslims, or sometimes some Muslims, says that we are a people of mourning and we are a people of crying all the time, especially in the months of Muharram and Safar, because this is exactly what we do for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, for his trials and tribulations which he suffered in the fields of Karbala. But we also must remember, he says, that every Imam of ours has a different strategy in his lifetime to fight the oppression or to fight the oppressors of his time. Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum. For example, Imam Hussein alayhi salam has paid sacrifices of his own life and his family and his friends. But right after him, we see that Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, he was also in the Karbala, but after the event of Karbala, he gave us the penetrating and incisive prayers in which he mentioned all the great messages of fighting against oppression. Even though they were prayers, simple prayers that, you know, one can recite after salat or things like that. But these prayers has all those messages. So he actually changed the strategy according and during his times. So he has a different socio-political order. So he used the way of prayers. And if we look at the life of every single ma'asum, every single member of the 14 Masumin, we would find out that each and every individual found a distinct way of preaching according to his own socio-political orders. So this is one of the great messages we can learn from this speech of Imam Khomeini. Inshallah, till the next episode, fi amanillah. Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum. Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum. Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
Italy has abandoned China's Belt and Road Initiative. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The South China Morning Post has covered this story and tells us more. Italy's participation in Chinese President Xi Jinping's flagship foreign policy tool, the Belt and Road Initiative, is drawing to a close, with Rome expected to pull the plug on the four-year saga by the end of this year. By not renewing a memorandum of understanding signed in 2019, Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni will ensure no country is a member of both the Group of Seven rich countries and China's infrastructure bonanza. The final nail in the coffin appeared to be hammered into place last week when Italian Defense Minister Guido Crosetto called the decision to join the initiative improvised and atrocious. Giorgia Meloni is expected to travel to Beijing in autumn to explain the decision to Xi Jinping in person after meeting US President Joe Biden in Washington last week. The writing has been on the wall for some time. Even on the campaign trail, Meloni described the decision to join the Belt and Road Initiative as a big mistake. Managing the fallout of the situation, however, puts the country's first far-right leader since the Second World War in an unenviable position. The decision comes as most of Western Europe is trying to rebalance its ties with China. But while Brussels has left its de-risking strategy deliberately vague, partly to offer EU members diplomatic cover when disentangling themselves from parts of the Chinese supply chain, no such ambiguity is available to Giorgia Meloni. The issue for Italy right now is how to move out of the Belt and Road, which is a political and not an economic tool, while maintaining or maybe strengthening the economic links with China. That is the challenge that Meloni faces, according to Lorenzo Codogno, chief economist at the Italian Ministry of Economy and Finance from 2006 to 2015. In effect, Italy faces being punished twice for joining the Belt and Road Initiative and without harvesting any of the economic rewards it might have hoped for. When we signed the Memorandum of Understanding, we didn't get any significant economic advantage, and now, since the overall geopolitical context is forcing us to go out, we again lose out. We first lost reputationally as far as Western countries were concerned, and now we lose reputation in the eyes of China, according to Giuliano Nocci, vice-rector of the Politecnico di Milano University and a former advisor to the Italian government. Giuliano Nocci said, signing up to the Belt and Road program without any side deals that would have, for example, granted Italian goods better access to the Chinese market was a mistake. Why can German products enter the market and ours not? He asked. This sort of logic was rife at the time. In 2019, Luigi Di Maio, then Italy's economy minister, said the reason for joining was to rebalance Italy's trade deficit with China. For China, losing Italy, the Belt and Road's richest Western member and a key node on the original Silk Road, will be a symbolic blow, even if not unexpected. Coinciding with his state visit 4 years ago, President Xi Jinping wrote that the agreement would cultivate the soil of bilateral relations and ensure that it can come to a new and richer flowering. But even then, a new geopolitical reality was setting in. Just 11 days before the agreement was signed, the European Union branded China a systemic rival in a now infamous paper that established its triptych policy towards the world's second largest economy. China's Global Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. Italian Defence Minister Guido Crosetto said in an interview recently that the previous government made an improvised and atrocious decision when it joined the China-proposed Belt and Road Initiative. The issue today is, he said, how to walk back from the Belt and Road Initiative without damaging relations with Beijing. This is the strongest message sent by a cabinet minister of the current Italian government since speculation that Italy may not renew the China-Italy Belt and Road Initiative Memorandum of Understanding surfaced. However, it must be pointed out that it's abnormal for a defence minister to make such comments. It's known to all that the Belt and Road Initiative is a regional economic cooperation framework which has nothing to do with national defence. To evaluate its actual achievements, it should be the Foreign Trade Department, the Economic Development Department, or even the Treasury Department that are qualified. As Italian Defence Minister, Guido Crosetto is inappropriate to take the lead to blast Italy's economic cooperation with China, even just from the perspective of his position alone, and his statement is also seriously inconsistent with the facts. For example, Crosetto said the Belt and Road Initiative multiplied China's exports to Italy but did not have the same effect on Italian exports to China. But in fact, for more than 4 years, the bilateral trade volume between China and Italy has repeatedly hit new highs. From 2019 to 2022, it increased by nearly 42% against this trend. Last year, it reached nearly $78 billion. From 2019 to 2021, Italy's exports to China increased by 42%. In the first 5 months of this year, Italy's exports to China increased significantly by 58%. These figures irrefutably reflect the strong effect of the Belt and Road Initiative, which is not what Crosetto said at all. However, on the other hand, although the statement made by the Italian Defence Minister is very awkward, it seems normal in today's political environment in the United States and Europe. In terms of economic cooperation with China, it is often the security and defense officials who have the most radical attitude. The officials who are actually in charge of the economy appear to be much more moderate. This exactly shows how seriously the United States and the West overstretch security issues. Crosetto is just the latest example. In addition, the timing of Crosetto's rhetoric is also doubtful, and the United States is obviously behind it. Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has just concluded her visit to the United States. There have been speculations that Meloni might withdraw from the Belt and Road Initiative to show loyalty to the US, but it was proved untrue afterward. But after meeting with President Joe Biden, Giorgia Meloni said that the Italian government will make a decision on the Belt and Road Initiative before December, emphasizing keeping a constructive dialogue open with Beijing and revealing her willingness to visit China. This also reflects Italy's current dilemma. It wants Washington's political recognition, but it is unwilling to give up economic cooperation with China, and it does not want to pick just one. It is clear who is responsible for Italy's current difficult situation. Since it decided to join the Belt and Road Initiative in 2019, the United States has exerted strong pressure on Italy and almost labelled Italy as a traitor to the West. At that time, the New York Times even described Italy as a Trojan horse of the Western world, allowing China's economic and potentially military and political expansion to reach into the heart of Europe. After the change of the Italian government, Washington saw an opportunity and stepped up pressure on Italy. Just before Giorgio Meloni's visit to the United States, John Kirby, Director of Strategic Communications for the National Security Council, publicly educated Italy about the lack of reward for economic partnerships with China and said, "We've created an alternative." This is indeed an intriguing scene. While the United States and the West are hyping vigilance against the Belt and Road Initiative, they have also launched imitations of the Belt and Road Initiative, such as Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment of G7 and the Global Gateway Initiative of the European Union. Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. According to Kishore Mahbubani, a former diplomat who served as Singapore's permanent representative to the United Nations, the US and the West learn from and imitate the Belt and Road Initiative while suppressing and smearing it, further showing that the Belt and Road Initiative was put forward with a long-term vision and in line with the general trend of the times. Unlike the multilateralism upheld by the Belt and Road Initiative, history has given answers time and time again to what role the imitations based on geopolitics and hegemony can play.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we try to answer your queries, your issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. And the answers are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified family. Well, today we have the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member at Al Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Yes, thank you very much.
Well, we have been discussing some of the important things that parents can do to encourage their children to be at community service, to be generous, to be helping the needy. And we want something else to be taught to the teenagers, and that is Islamic art. Yes. So, Professor, how can parents introduce their children to Islamic art and architecture?
Yes, thank you very much. Of course, when it comes to art and when it comes to any of these issues, these human skills and human crafts which are related to that sense of the aesthetic sense that is there in all human
right.
beings. This has to be developed. This has to be given an opportunity to become to develop and become stronger. But it is if it is channelized into a specific direction, then it becomes more beautiful.
More
it becomes
beautiful.
Especially when it becomes it relates to Islamic thought and Islamic. The Islamic thought and Islamic values and Islamic practices, when it comes together with that, then its beauty, the beauty in those things becomes more, it becomes more apparent and it becomes more vitalized.
Right.
So, I mean, yes, art in any form is a manifestation of that aesthetic sense in human beings.
Right.
And it should be developed. It should be given an opportunity. It may be in the form of painting. It may be in the form of sculpture. It may be in the form of architecture. It may be in the form of embroidery.
Calligraphy.
It can be in the form of carpet weaving and so many things. So these arts and crafts, these arts and crafts which are there, in the whole world, in many manifestations, it is something which comes out of human nature. It is a part of human nature that a human being, as he or she, as a human being, wants to go after good things. He or she wants to go after beautiful things.
Right.
And this beauty is manifested and shows itself in the form of art forms. So it can be calligraphy, it can be even, as I said, carpeting, painting, whatever. So if it is centered around these issues of which bring out the Islamic faith, bring out the and they express Islamic faith, Islamic thing. We can't say art is Islamic or not Islamic. Art is art.
Art is art.
Art is art. Painting, craftsmanship. These fine arts, as they are called, classical arts, fine arts, they are art. You can't say something art is Islamic or something is not Islamic. But if the theme around which they are developed is of the theme and the thought and the ideas and the values which have been expressed, then that can be called Islamic.
Okay.
For example, when you talk about architecture, when you talk about living in a house, what type of house does Islam envisage? Is living in the flat something which is good for us according to Islam, or we should be living in independent villa type homes? So these are all manifestations of the various Islam, the thought process that Islam evolves in human beings.
Right.
So if that is expressed in the form of architecture, in the form of the designs that we carry out in our architecture, it becomes takes an Islamic color.
Right.
This has to be developed. So number one, the training and the upbringing of our children in a way that that aesthetic sense comes out, the potential which is there, it is actualized. It can take many forms. It can take many types. It can become of many types.
Right.
But the important thing is then it is that we need to channelize it in such a way that art pieces are coming out which reflect Islam.
Right.
Which reflect Islamic values.
Right.
Especially they don't go against them.
Exactly. We'll discuss more with you, Professor, after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Professor Salman Akavi discussing how important it is for parents to encourage the teenagers towards Islamic art.
So, yes, even, for example, one of the art forms or one of the forms that is music. Now, many people, teenagers nowadays, they want to, you know, even older people, they are very much influenced by music. Now, music is an art form. It
right.
is a form of the, it is an expression of that aesthetic sense which is there in us. So we can't suppress that. We cannot completely, you know, say that our life is devoid of music.
Right.
No, it can't be. It is a part of our lives, but it has to be channelized into the right direction.
Right.
Music, of course, in the general sense, when we recite the Quran in a beautiful way, in a melodious way, that is also musical. That has music in it. This music of the Quran is a unique form when the recitation is done in a way that is has been emphasized, that has been shown.
The surahs in itself have rhythm.
Yes, so that is not. It is also a sort of music. Or when we recite a noha or maybe a marathiya, so the lyrics themselves are a form of art.
Right.
And when they are recited in a melodious
way,
in a particular, that becomes musical.
Right.
There's a melody in it. So all of these expressions.
So parents should not be suppressing their teenager.
They shouldn't be doing that. They should be channelizing it. Number one, the general rules, any art form which goes against the explicit commands of Allah Almighty, they should be refrained from. For example, your child wants to make a painting of a nude figure. So that is not, Islam doesn't like that.
Right, recommended.
That's not recommended. That's not. Or a musical, a song which is, the lyrics are not nice, they are bad lyrics. Or the rhythm is not according to the, it's against, arouses in us feelings which are lowly feelings.
Right.
Or it motivates us to do wrong things.
Okay.
Yes, you have, for example, music, you have war music. Maybe the national anthem of a country.
Right.
So these things, they are good. They motivate you to carry out good deeds for your country, for your people. They're all right, but they shouldn't be in a way gathering risha, carrying out wrong deeds.
Right.
So, I mean, we need to teach our children to carry out such arts and perform those arts which are, number one, go against the Islamic teachings and values. And number two, more than that, they even express those feelings and thoughts and values.
Right.
So especially after this revolution in the Islamic Republic of Iran, we see that the art forms which are taking place, the paintings, the designs, they are expressing those Islamic values, those
right.
Islamic thoughts.
Exactly.
The revolution has given a great impetus to the development of art in Iran.
Professor, we'll discuss more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet ﷺ said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Professor Salman Naqvi discussing the importance of Islamic art that should be inculcated in our children. Professor, we were talking about the Islamic art which is widespread in the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Yes, so for example, we see when we talk about the 8 years of the war that took place, the war that was imposed upon Iran by Iraq and with the support of the imperial powers.
Right.
So now you see that we have so many, films are being made. Of course, there's a lot to be done. But you see the paintings and the art forms that express the spirit behind that effort
right.
that took place in the war in the defense of Islam and the defense of Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran. Those caused a great a lot of people came in and they started making paintings and even starting they started to write novels and books and so many for example lyrics and songs were started. The revolution itself, when it was coming into what was becoming successful, there were so many of these national songs and national right. anthems that created that motivation for the public. So at the wartime, it took upon a special way. In other ways also, when it comes to the progress that is being made in different aspects of Islam, of the Islamic Republic, in education, in science and technology,
right.
all apart of them give rise to different forms of art,
right,
which
right.
are given.
Right.
Which
I've just been recently in a film festival here in Iran, and it was so amazing. A nine-year-old girl won that festival who had made a film on resistance. And I was amazed how she could do that. And she had captured her old movies through a mobile phone. So even our children, especially teens, who are interested in filmmaking and documentary making, should not be discouraged by the fact that they don't have a good camera, they don't have DSLRs, and they don't have enough finance to do it. This nine-year-old in itself was an example for like so many people out there. And it was the 17th film festival where I saw this nine-year-old girl winning the award.
Yes, so this is, again, a form of education for our children. They themselves, when they start getting involved in these issues and the art forms that they can produce, the design, especially nowadays, people are working on the computer and in the virtual world and designing and making
graphics,
motion films and videos, and so many things are there. It's so. This is a great opportunity for the expression of that, you know, feeling of beauty and aesthetics that are inside us. But again, they should be channelized into issues which pertain to Islam, to religion, to the revolution, to the to resistance, to human issues. These are things which we need our children to, you know, work upon.
Okay.
And if that is opportunity is provided, they come up with things which may be something new, something, you know, some innovative things,
right.
which we might not be able to think of. So, I mean, there's a great deal of opportunity today in society to make our children grow up in a society which is thinking for the future, which is moving towards the future. For example, if our children are made to realize what is going to come with the advent of the Imam Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, they will start thinking of things which we cannot maybe think of.
Right.
So we need our children to come up with these ideas and with these thoughts. So we need to give them those directions, those
particular
teachings,
direction.
And then give them freedom to, you know, express themselves.
Right. Thank you so much, Professor, for being with us and for that beautiful discussion. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIP English Radio. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran warns the U.S. against any provocation as Washington announces the arrival of 3,000 military personnel in the Red Sea.